Tactopia.
Uh-oh. Have I lost you?
Tactopia.
Tactopia. Tactopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus, HI-messen, Index Award, Innovation Center Danmark og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tactopia.
Tactopia.
Teknosfæren. Ja, det er sådan en slags atmosfære af teknologi, som vi mennesker vi har lagt ud over kloden. Det er alle de informationer, der drøner gennem satellitter og fiberkabler og telefonnetværk og alt muligt andet. Men spørgsmålet er, om ikke den her teknosfære, den i virkeligheden er ved at kvæle os og planeten og kvæle og ødelægge vores forhold til naturen. Det mener i hvert fald Paolo Antonelli, der er kurator på Museum of Modern Art i New York, og hun har faktisk lavet en udstilling, der hedder Broken Nature, som har kørt i den italienske by Milano hen over sommeren. Hun siger, at vi har ødelagt vores bånd til naturen, og det er så det, hun er begyndt at analysere. Grunden til, at jeg snakker om Paolo Antonelli, det er, fordi hun sidder i juryen for den store Designpris Index Award, der bliver uddelt her i København den 6. september. Så i dag der kan du møde hende og høre om hendes idéer om design og hvordan vi redder om ikke verden og menneskene, så i hvert fald vores eftermæle. Og du kan også møde Arnold Wasserman, som er en designer, der er meget berømt inden for det, man kalder for design thinking, og han sidder også i juryen for Index Award. Men allerførst så skal vi hilse på Paolo Antonelli, fordi det hun vil med sin udstilling Broken Nature, det er som sagt at analysere, hvordan vi har ødelagt vores bånd til naturen, og om vi kan reparere de her bånd. Men samtidig så stiller hun også et langt mere alvorligt spørgsmål, fordi titlen Broken Nature indeholder tanken om, hvad der egentlig skal ske med os mennesker. Er der overhovedet brug for os, og er vi i færd med at udslette os selv? Og hvis det er tilfældet, hvad efterlader vi os så? Hvordan vil vi gerne huskes? Og hvem er det egentlig, der skal huske os? Og hvad skal de huske os for? Jeg tog en Skype-forbindelse til Paolo Antonelli og spurgte hende, hvad Broken Nature egentlig går ud på.
Yeah, you know, sometimes you start with a concept, especially when it's an exhibition about contemporary design. You start with an idea. And then in the course of the preparation of the exhibition, the idea gets shaped and refined. So things become clearer. The initial idea of Broken Nature, and I kept it because it was such a good title, is that we humans have ties with nature that have many, many ties that in some cases we have severed forever, we have broken forever. And in other cases we have tested and maybe weakened, but they can still be fixed. And when I talk about ties, it's everything. You know, think about ties with other human beings, ties with other species, ties with the environment. There's a thread linking us to pretty much any animal, to the glaciers. And think about those that we have cut, all the species that we have pushed to extinction. You know, so those are the threads. Imagine this amazing array of threads. Some have been broken. So the idea of broken nature was coming from this sense of a broken object. And, you know, in some cultures, a broken object is broken, too bad, sad, that's the end. In other cultures, a broken object is the beginning of a new object, right? So there's both a sense of hope and a sense of pessimism in the exhibition that has been interestingly picked up by the public. You know, actually, no, the public tends to see the bright side, or at least the optimistic side. It's the critics that say sometimes that, oh, it's such a dark exhibition, also because I talk about extinction quite openly. And I think, is it a dark show? Yeah, I hope so. I like dark. But it also has a lot of degrees of freedom and a lot of energy that can be picked. You know, once you know what your limits are, you can really get excited and get to work.
So what you're saying is that this threat of extinction of the human race will maybe help us to act?
Yes, let me put it this way. we will become extinct because everything and everybody dies. You know, death is part of life. So it goes without saying that our species will become extinct. We do not have control on that. We have some control over the when, and we definitely have control over the how, right? So when you know that you're going to die as a human being, one of the first things that you do is you think of your legacy. It's natural. You think of what you're going to leave to your children, your children's children, and maybe even farther down the line. So as a species, we should do the same. We should think, now that we know that we are mortals as a species, we should think of our legacy. We should think of what we want to leave behind. Do we want to really drive the planet into the ground and be remembered as complete morons? Or do we want to leave a sense of at least poetry, goodwill, and we tried, you know, we tried and we loved other species and we loved ourselves and we made the best of what we have.
But who are we leaving this for? I mean, who will be sort of the spectators in the future?
Don't know. That's science fiction, you know. That's you can say, if you believe in the singularity, it's going to be AI maybe infused with us, or it could be ants and silkworms, or I really don't know. That is beyond my pay grade and above my pay grade. But what I can say is, since I am a so-called expert of the now and of the immediate future, I can only proceed with little footsteps, right? And my little footsteps are, let's start making a better environment, better things, and making a better world. And better means more economical, more ethical, more elegant formally, because I do believe in formal intention, and also more empathetic with other humans, with other species, and also with species that we don't know yet.
Is it possible for us to fix nature, to fix it, instead of just dreaming ourselves back to something that was more sustainable?
Well, one of the biggest learning experiences from preparing this show is to understand something very simple but very, very powerful. It's not us and nature. We are part of nature, right? So that is a big deal, because once you start thinking that way, we can fix ourselves, and in the process we do our best, and maybe nature will, you know, respond by fixing itself, and other parts of nature will take the example or simply do better because we are doing better or because we're doing less. So yeah, once you think about the fact that we are part of nature, yeah, definitely. And I never think of going back, by the way. I don't believe in going back to the past. I think there's an evolution that might imply using less plastics. And I'm mentioning plastics just because two nights ago I did a whole salon about plastics. I do these salons at MoMA that show how the museum can help you think about very important matters of life, like how to protest or how to die, you know, death and aging. So we had one salon about plastics, and we were just remembering how gorgeous plastics are sometimes, and how in the 1960s they were really a symbol of the future, and also a symbol of how one could give access to people with a smaller income. You know, so they were a democratizing agent, they were exciting, giving a sense of the future. And it's only now that we know that many plastics are toxic, not all of them, and that we should use less of them. That doesn't mean going back. We'll go forward. We're thinking of bioplastics. We are thinking of eliminating virgin plastic and single-use plastic. So you understand there's an evolution. It's never the idea of, like, let's go back. Well, in some cases, maybe we'll bring back the glass bottle to a milk dispenser as opposed to buying Tetra Pak. And, you know, so we might do that. But it's never going backwards.
And in this process, we're still
sort of making a footprint on nature and on the planet.
Always. I mean, but even snails leave a footprint. You know what I'm saying? It just depends on what kind of footprint you leave. So if you leave a footprint that can go back into the big system of nature and be either degraded naturally or can be transformed into another type of energy, that's all good. It's when we consume without any giving back that we leave a negative footprint. I shouldn't say negative footprint because that's a technical term, that we leave a footprint that's unwelcome.
And now you mentioned that you did this salon at MoMA in New York, and you have your exhibition Broken Nature in Milan. Do you experience any differences when you work on both continents? Are your ideas being perceived in different manners?
Yeah, well, it's more how people come to my ideas. So in Milano, I am in a city that loves design, that is very familiar with design. So I always make exhibitions for citizens, right? I don't make exhibitions for experts. Experts will probably enjoy them, but I always think, without being corny, I always think of kids like age 5 to 15, because they are really tough when it comes, we can go to 17, but they're really tough when it comes to criticizing design, and they really get it. So I think of them all the time. And in Milan, I know that they're going to come in hordes, right? They're going to be many. They're going to come. They're going to understand. In the United States, sometimes it's a little more iffy. It might be that people come to the museum to see Matisse and Picasso, and then they stumble upon a design show, and they really enjoy it, and they stay there for 2 hours. So design has a more clear position in people's culture in Europe than it does here in the United States. That's the big difference. Then there are 1,500 other differences. You know, I also remember I'm in New York. So in New York, I do these salons. You know, I do a salon on angels, and it's packed. You know, I have two overflow rooms. Or, you know, like the day before yesterday, I don't know if you heard, but there was a helicopter that crashed on a rooftop in Midtown Manhattan, like a block away from here. It was raining. It was a horrible day. Packed, you know, like once again, overflow room, 1,500 people online. So New Yorkers might not understand design, but they are so inquisitive. So as we say here, you could open an envelope, they all come. And that is wonderful, you know. So there's much more intellectual curiosity displayed in New York, but in Milan, people understand design right away.
You mentioned before that we shouldn't see nature as something outside of ourselves, but see ourselves as part of nature. Humans are part of nature. So when you call your exhibition Broken Nature, it could also be Broken Humans.
Yes, of course. It's broken us. Yes, it's broken us all. Mm-mm. And that's exactly what really made me change my way of thinking while preparing this show.
How did it change your way of thinking?
It changed because it made me realize that the issue is not us versus them, but it's us versus us in a way. So it's the self-destructive nature of what we're doing that is really something that has to be understood and internalized by everybody.
How do you see the tech world? I mean, the tech world is very dominating today in design and in the everyday objects and the way that we sort of live and use the world and our resources. What are your perspectives on the tech world?
You know, the tech world is not homogeneous. There are many different types of companies. I know that there are companies that speak nice words, but then they don't really act. And I know there are companies that are a little more honest and frankly don't give a damn. I mean, if you think of Apple and the overpackaging and the fact that you cannot take apart the phones and you cannot recycle the parts, you know, just like that's the epitome of what you should not do. And in fact, in Broken Nature, we show the Fairphone. Are you familiar with the Fairphone? You must, right?
Yeah.
Yes, so we show the Fairphone as the example. So there's tech software, tech hardware, but the funny thing is that pretty much all tech software companies are trying to go into hardware because they realize that it's a way to lock in customers. So you're seeing Facebook doing hardware, you're seeing Google, of course, doing hardware, and they don't really seem to worry too much about the supply chain and about the electronic waste. Other companies, you know, when you talk about tech companies, then there's all the websites and all the dissemination companies that are trying to actually show how you can do better. So you see, big tech, I don't think, cares enough. Small tech is instead trying to, in many cases, support grassroots efforts. We're talking about a general attitude. So you and I are having a conversation about design and technology, but as I was mentioning to you before, the whole world is reacting to a laissez-faire attitude that had to do with unabashed capitalism. Now, some of us, myself included, I don't think capitalism is completely negative by all means. I think it could be a force for good, but I think we have not kept it in check. We, the citizens, have let institutions become really lazy when it comes to keeping companies in check. The fact, the law that profit rules and that the function of a company is to make profits for its shareholders is a little bit wacky. You know what I'm saying? Is that really all that it's about? So it's our responsibility as citizens to question all of these principles. And frankly, we have not done our job in a long time. So I'm glad that we're all waking up.
Ja, og det her, det var altså et wake-up call fra Paola Antonelli, der er kurator på Museum of Modern Art i New York, og altså har lavet udstillingen Broken Nature i Milano. Hun sidder som sagt i juryen for Index Award, der bliver uddelt her fredag den 6. september her i København. Prisen bliver uddelt hver andet år, og undertitlen er Design to Improve Life, altså design, der kan forbedre livet for os mennesker. Missionen for den internationale designpris, som har hjemme her i København, har siden 2005 været at uddele en pris for ting, som gør livet bedre for mange, og har tænkes ikke bare på gode stole eller smukke lamper, men på designløsninger, som kan give højere livskvalitet og nye muligheder for verdens fattigste. For eksempel så er prisen blevet uddelt til sugerøret LifeStraw, der kan rense forurenet vand. Den er også blevet uddelt til dronefirmaet Zipline, som har stor succes med at levere mad og medicin til afrikanere, for eksempel, som bor i utilgængelige landområder. En af dem, der har været med fra starten i Index Award, det er Arnold Wasserman, som er en amerikansk pioner inden for designtænkning. Han mener, at kultur og menneskelig adfærd det bliver glemt i dag til fordel for økonomi og teknologi, når vi for eksempel taler om den fjerde industrielle revolution. Gennem sit arbejde med Index Award har Arnold Wasserman tænkt meget over, hvordan teknologi påvirker os mennesker og den verden, vi bygger, ikke mindst vores store byer. Han mener, at vi har en slem tendens til at sætte økonomi og teknologi i front, i stedet for at tænke på menneskelig adfærd og kultur. Især når vi taler om den fjerde industrielle revolution, der lige nu er ved at forandre hele vores måde at producere og arbejde på. Og så er det, at designeren kommer ind i billedet og begynder at stille spørgsmål og siger, jamen, måske skulle vi gøre det på en anden måde.
Arnold Wasserman. I'm a recovering industrial designer. And I graduated as an industrial designer from Carnegie Mellon University in 1956. That was the early Jurassic era of design. And since then, I've worked, say, the first half of my life on what I would call straight-ahead design. That's products of all kinds, you know, lamps, chairs, teacups, what most cars, what most people think of as design. But for the second half of my career, I've been working on things that are much harder to talk about, much more interesting, and much more useful to the world. And that is design for sustainability, impact design, social design, all things that are very hard for people to quite understand what the design bit is in all of that. But I don't worry about it being difficult to talk about. I'm just interested to do it.
So you're actually designing for human behavior?
Not designing for human behavior. Human behavior comes at us. The humans have the behavior. We have the job of fitting the world to human behavior, desires, needs, emergent aspirations, things they want but don't know they want until we show them what might be possible. So not interested in shaping behavior, interested in discovering behavior, particularly the latent and the tacit, things that people are interested in that they don't even know themselves, but that we help them articulate by presenting them with possibilities. So that's one of the roles of design, I think, is to find out what's going on inside people's heads.
But you mentioned the sustainability. Mm-hmm. Isn't it necessary to change the habits of or the behaviors of humans to gain sustainability?
Yeah, but they have to do that. What we do is we. I think of design as giving tangible form to a valuable idea. It's the ideas that are of interest to me. The tangible forms change over time. Many of the ideas are perpetual ideas. We carry them around in our psyche, carry them around in our consciousness, we carry them around by virtue of the culture that we're in. The designer's job is to discover the deep understandings, the deep and tacit and inarticulate things, that ways that people really want to live, and have them tell us, discover what it is that they want to do. I think that all of the sustainability discussion is too much of a technology push. It's not enough of a human pull. I think we expect that we are going to put new technologies into the world. This is one of the arguments that I have, however much I ascribe to the World Economic Forum Fourth Industrial Revolution agenda. I think it's way too much technology and economics push, and not enough behavior, social, cultural pull. So I see the designer's job as connecting the two, coming into some deeper understanding of what it is that people will really want if it is articulated for them, and we help give them language to express it, and also offer them options that they can adopt or reject, or say, I don't understand that, or that's not me, that's not my life. All of these are ways to uncover what are the latent and tacit things. I do believe that people want to live a sustainable life. They just don't have language, and they don't have practice at what that feels like. You know? So one of our jobs as designers is to give them options and to propose modalities of being in the world that they otherwise would not encounter in their normal daily life. And then watch what they do with them. And then reiterate. This is called design thinking. You know, you observe what's going on, and then you offer conceptual new options or ideas. Watch what people do with them. Iterate, you know, and gradually move toward an adoptable new modality of some kind, whether it's mobility or species extinction or carbon, CO2, or water security, any of the whole agenda, of sustainability factors. I think one of the things that we have in our favor is that 70% by the, 2050, 70% of the world's population will live in metropolitan areas. Now, so is the metropolitan, the metro region is really the unit of design for the future. know, central governments can sometimes determine good things, determine bad things. But in metropolitan regions, people are much closer to the governance and to the decision-making process and can feel immediately in their own lives what it means if, let's say, their metropolitan region, as we're trying to do in San Francisco, as you're doing in many of the northern countries in Europe, is offering new alternatives for ways to live sustainably. Well, some of that's at the national level, but most of it is at the metropolitan region level. So I see the locus of design for sustainability is in the metropolitan region. If that is so, we have to understand the political, economic, social, and cultural entailments of what it means to live in dense metropolitan regions, where we're going to get our food, how we're going to move around, what kind of work we're going to do, how we're going to address income disparity. That it, I see that primarily being the design job of this century. Right? I think I might have diverged from
your
question.
Fine. No.
Yeah.
I even forgot my question myself.
Yeah.
But I think it's interesting that you point to the metropolitan areas when it comes to design, because, I mean, we live in something which is which has removed itself from nature and from sort of the origins of humans to living in an environment which is completely designed. So it must be somehow a designer's dream to design for this future.
Sure. Design is a multi-faced animal. So we have designed a lot of things that have gone by we, I'm talking about not just professional designers, people who have a capital D stamped on their head because they got a degree in design. I'm talking about design broadly construed. It was the application of technology to valuable ideas. We've designed ourselves into a corner where we are destroying the support system of life on the planet. And there's ever greater recognition of that fact in all quarters of life. This I find very encouraging. There's recognition, because you have to have recognition before you can have understanding. You have to have understanding before you can have adoption. So as we move, you know, from, oh, something's going on that we have to do something about, through acceptance of that idea, through an understanding of what's entailed in doing something different than the way we're doing it. But the power for the change that we're talking about, and how we use the planet and the resources and the rainforest and the topsoil and the water resource and the CO2 level, the power for that understanding lies in the metropolitan regions, because that's where universities are, that's where our centers of thought are, that's where the machinery for change exists. So you have to embed a new consciousness. It seems counterintuitive. In order to understand the desertification, you know, of southwestern Russia, there aren't any think tanks there. There aren't any universities there. The people who have to work on that are in the cities, right? So there has to be an increased understanding, and it is happening. We say, is it happening fast enough? Will it happen in 12 years, or will we exceed, 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit? Or is it centigrade? I forget which one. the target that we must not exceed. Well, we have all of these drop-dead targets. We have, by 2050, we know that we need 50% more food for 10 billion people, to live a healthy, sustainable life in the world. Well, some of the answer to how we get from here to there lies in the large arable areas of the world where food is grown. But the science and the design alternatives of how we move from a take-make-waste civilization to a preservation, cultivation, nurturing, sustainability civilization, the knowledge for that lies within big city. The exploratory knowledge lies within the big cities. Now I have to modify that. The pointy-headed people in the big cities have to go to the farmlands, and they have to learn from the farmers what the farmers have known for 10,000 years that we have forgotten. To me, these are design questions. These are questions of large-scale social, political, economic design. And unless we address them as such, then we're just going to let people who can monetize control over all the levers of sustainable life on Earth tell us what to do. No, we have to tell them what to do. And that means we have to redesign political institutions so that they can't be bought, you know, by monopolies and oligopolies. And that includes, yes, thank you very much, Facebook and Google, even though some of my best friends work there. Well, Facebook and Google, they'll hire officers of ethics, you know, chief ethics officer, and that will change what they do and the impact of what they do in the world. So we have to redesign everything. We have to redesign our institutions, the fundamental structure of what we call democracy in this century has to be redesigned. That is the design project of this century. My idea is that design is not a sequence of separate objects. Design is a pathway of ideas, and the artifacts, whether they're physical or atom-based or digital or whatever they are milestones along the pathway of evolving idea that has merit. We gave an award to the Tesla Roadster, all-electric Tesla Roadster. I was a big proponent of giving it an award. Almost everyone else on the jury, I think I had to threaten to defenestrate myself if we did not give it an award. Everybody else said, it's a rich man's toy, $150,000 rich man's toy. How does that express the index agenda, our values? And I said, okay, watch what's going to happen. Up until now, having an electric car, owning an electric car meant having a little golf cart, which you bought out of virtue. That this thing is going to become an aspirational object. It goes from 0 to 60 in 4 seconds. Right? It's irresistible. Right? It's a hot thing, and it's all electric. This is going to pull through electric vehicle world. Production and adoption worldwide. I could see that because I could see it as a point along a trajectory instead of as an isolated artifact. And of course, the Tesla, that Roadster was a lousy car. It was built on a Lotus frame, which was one of the worst sports cars ever designed. Completely unreliable, always in the garage, mechanically disaster, right? But it was the social and cultural aspirational and psychological aspirational dimension of it that has basically pulled through the electric vehicle into the mass market worldwide. So these are the kinds of things that we're looking for, the things that are the early signs and the weak signals for what could be and, let's be ethical and moral about it, should be the ways that the world is going to change in the future. We're looking for those early signs of the forces that are going to drive positive change into the future. And that's sort of the ethos of Index. And it's my design, that's the it underlies my philosophy of design these days.
Yeah, det var altså Arne Wasserman, den amerikanske design thinking guru, som også sidder i juryen for Index Award, og netop Index Award, ja, den bliver uddelt her fredag den 6. september, hvor fem idéer får en pris hver. Og nu siger jeg idéer, det kan jo så også være personen eller virksomheden bag idéen, der får en pris. Dem kan vi ikke afsløre lige nu, men du kan møde dem i den næste udgave af Techtopia. Og det bliver bestemt ikke kedeligt, fordi jeg kan godt love dig allerede nu, at det bliver nogle rimelig udspacede idéer, du kommer til at møde. Og flere af dem er faktisk allerede ført ud i livet og er i gang med at forbedre livet for både os mennesker og for planeten generelt. Og her til sidst, der skal vi også lige have et podkort fra podcasten Transformator.
Er det virkelig muligt at stjæle en anden persons digitale liv, vedkommendes penge, profiler og mailkonti, ved at anskaffe sig et SIM-kort til vedkommendes mobil? Det kan man sagtens. Man kan simpelthen bare gå lige ind i en telebutik og købe sådan et kort.
Det startede jo i virkeligheden med, at jeg havde brug for et nyt SIM-kort selv. Jeg gik ned i en telebutik for ikke at skulle vente på PostNord. Så går jeg ned, siger mit telefonnummer, siger, at jeg har brug for et nyt SIM-kort, og det får jeg så. Så går jeg hjem med et SIM-kort i hånden og undrer mig lidt, fordi jeg havde jo læst amerikanske historier, hvor folk er blevet franaret en masse penge, en masse webkonti, hvor det er gået rigtig galt for folk, at folk har kunne overtage deres SIM-kort uden at vise ID.
I denne uges Transformator udøver vi SIM-swap og viser, hvor langt man kan trænge ind i fremmedes digitale liv på ganske få minutter.
Du har lyttet til Techtopia. Jeg linker til nogle af de ting, vi har talt om her i podcasten fra vores hjemmeside techtopia.dk. Du kan også skrive til mig på henrik@techtopia.dk. Du kan følge podcasten på Twitter, @techtopia.dk. Og du kan deltage i diskussionen i vores Facebook-gruppe. Der er op mod 1.500 medlemmer nu, som alle sammen diskuterer teknologi. Den hedder Techtopia Backstage, så det søger du bare på, og så kaster du dig ud i diskussionen om teknologi. Og så er der kun tilbage at sige på genhør, og husk nu at passe godt på vores allesammens blå planet. Techtopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus, HI-messen, Index Award, Innovation Center Danmark og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Techtopia.
Techtopia.
Have I lost you?